Okay, so last week, God took the people of Israel miraculously across the Jordan River. So they have officially passed over into the land that he promised them. God is keeping his good promises. And the people and the kings of the land, because remember, it is inhabited, they hear about it, or maybe they see it. I had my, in my mind, I was thinking, because I was like, oh, well, they didn't see it on the news. I was like, they heard it through the grapevine. You know, so they have heard about it. So Joshua 5, verse 1. As soon as all the kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan to the west and all the kings of the Canaanites who were by the sea heard that the Lord had dried up the waters of the Jordan for the people of Israel until they had crossed over, their hearts melted and there was no longer any spirit in them because of the people of Israel. So the kings of Canaan are terrified of the God of Israel. And they are not going to go on the offensive against God's people right now. They are basically frozen in fear. And this is such a provision from the Lord because of what happens next. So God has brought his people across. They're preparing to go into battle to take the land. And God stops them and is like, okay, so this is how we're going to prepare for battle. It's not a sword fighting lesson or a strategy. It's time to stop and remember who you are. We're going to reaffirm our family identity. And what that ends up looking like is we're going to circumcise all the males and we're going to have a feast. And y'all, I don't want it to pass by us that they're now, 5-10 miles from the people who would love to destroy them and know that they're coming in for battle. God has taken them across the river that would have kind of been some protection, brought them into a place where they are vulnerable, and then said, now it's time to do these things I'm going to tell you to do. They have to fully trust him that they're not going to get demolished while they do what he's telling them to do. Okay, so it's looking like a bit of a family reunion. My family is tiny. And sadly, not close, either by like relationship or proximity. So like I have aunts and uncles, I mean, that I knew, I grew up with, and cousins that if they sat down in a restaurant next to us in Oxford, my children would not know them. Isn't that a bummer? That's such a bummer. And it just kind of is how it was, and I did not have control over that. I was a kid. But I've always loved the idea, maybe because of that, of like big, big, loud, happy families. We say like my big Greek wedding and all, you know, all. And I'm like, oh, wouldn't it be cool to have a family like that? And I think of like you see, at, you know, I don't know, Disney World or for family reunions, they make a T-shirt. They make a family T-shirt. And I think that is so cheesy in the most awesome way. I want a family T-shirt, right? Because they're saying, this is my family. These are my people. You're going to see who my people are because you don't have my family T-shirt and you're not my people. And my people are special and set apart. This is my family T-shirt. So my dad's side of the family actually lives all the way in Ohio. And I did once get to go, and I was about 11, to a family reunion there. So they're all there. We just aren't seeing them. And the thing I remember is there was so much food, right? Because we often feast together when we're together as a family. But they called it a smorgasbord. It was like, it was not a potluck. It was a smorgasbord. And that has stuck with me forever, okay? So as we start looking at how God told his people to reaffirm their family identity, we're going to think of these two things as the family T-shirt and the smorgasbord, okay? As we get into Joshua, he tells them that they're supposed to circumcise all the males, right, and reaffirm and have the Passover. And John Card said that circumcision and the Passover were physical signs of a spiritual reality. So these two things are physical signs, things we can see, things we do, of a spiritual reality. And so sadly, these two things had not been done for all of the time they were in the wilderness. So that first generation of God's people had actually experienced the Passover. They had lived through that 10th plague. And then they had carried it out when they had crossed the Red Sea. And then in the time of the wilderness, after they disobeyed, they didn't celebrate the Passover every year like God had told them to. And they also hadn't circumcised any of their males in all of those 40 years. So we're going to start by looking at circumcision. Circumcision was a physical sign of the spiritual reality that they were in a covenant relationship with God. This is a sign that he's the daddy and they're the children. This is a sign. It was a covenant. That's like a contract between two parties. And so God is saying, you are my children, and they are responding with the sign of, and we are circumcising our males to show our side of the sign. Genesis 17 starts talking about that. God says, and I will establish my covenant between me and you and your offspring after you throughout their generations for an everlasting covenant, to be God to you and to your offspring after you. And I will give to you and your offspring after you the land of your sojournings, all the land of Canaan, for an everlasting possession, and I will be their God. You shall be circumcised in the flesh of your foreskins, and it shall be a sign of the covenant between me and you. Skipping down further. Any uncircumcised male who is not circumcised in the flesh of his foreskin shall be cut off from his people. He has broken my covenant. So, a little more involved than wearing a family t-shirt, right? But God has told them, this is how you are going to, one way I'm going to set you apart and mark you out as my family that's going to be different from everybody else. And then the other thing we're about to read about in chapter 5 is the Passover. And so, like we said, the Passover was the 10th plague that finally Pharaoh allowed them to leave Egypt, leave out of slavery. And God had told Moses to tell them to sacrifice a lamb and put the blood of the lamb over their doorpost as a sign that they trusted God to protect them. And so that night, the angel of death passes over, and anyone who didn't have the blood of the lamb, of a lamb on their doorpost, their firstborn died. And so in that we see both God passing over in judgment that they were saved from and then passing through all of that safely. Again, Exodus 12, 13, this is where it's talked about earlier. Passover, the blood shall be a sign for you on the houses where you are. And when I see the blood, I will pass over you and no plague will befall you to destroy you when I smite the land of Egypt. And so we see God protect everybody who trusted him. And they did something to show they were trusting him. They put that blood over and God showed protection. And so then they celebrate the Passover every year to remember that first Passover and remember how God brought them out of slavery. Okay, so now we have a little bit of a framework for circumcision and Passover and how God used those two things to really show family identity. Let's read Joshua. We're back in 5, verse 2. At that time, the Lord said to Joshua, make flint knives and circumcise the sons of Israel a second time. So note, remember, going into battle, all of the men, all of the fighting men are now being circumcised. And, you know, we're like, that was quite a recovery on the side of the river. Anyway, take that as you. Sorry. And this is the reason why Joshua circumcised them. All of the males of the people who came out of Egypt, all the men of war, had died in the wilderness, that first generation, on the way after they had come out of Egypt. Though all the people who came out had been circumcised, yet all the people who were born on the way in the wilderness after they had come out of Egypt had not been circumcised. For the people of Israel walked 40 years in the wilderness until all the nation, the men of war who came out of Egypt, perished because they did not obey the voice of the Lord. The Lord swore to them that he would not let them see the land that the Lord had sworn to their fathers to give to us, a land flowing with milk and honey. So it was their children whom he raised up in their place that Joshua circumcised. For they were uncircumcised because they had not been circumcised on the way. When the circumcising of the whole nation was finished, they remained in their places in the camp until they were healed. And the Lord said to Joshua, "Today I have rolled away the reproach of Egypt from you." And so the name of that place is called Gilgal to that day. And while the people of Egypt of Israel were encamped at Gilgal, they kept the Passover on the 14th day of the month in the evening on the plains of Jericho. And the day after the Passover, on that very day, they ate the produce of the land, unleavened cakes and parched grain, and the manna ceased the day after they ate of the produce of the land. And there was no longer manna for the people of Israel, but they ate of the fruit of the land of Canaan that year. What a beautiful completion of God fully bringing his people into the promised land. And he had cared for them and provided for them the whole time they were in the wilderness with manna. And now he's going to care for them and provide for them with the fruit and the bounty of the promised land. It's a beautiful completion. Okay, so for this chapter, a warning and an encouragement. Okay, a warning. The signs are very important, and they are just signs. So the generation of Israelites that came out of Egypt, they had the signs. They were circumcised. They kept the Passover. They did the signs. And then they still disobeyed. And then they still stopped trusting God and decided that they wanted to rebel and didn't trust him to do what he said he was going to do and asked to go back to Egypt. The sign is just a sign. The expectation is that the reality of the sign causes you to live differently. There's circumcision, and this shows that we're in a relationship with God. He's our God. We're his people. We're going to live like it. The Passover is celebrated. We celebrate that God saved us from slavery, which is in foreshadowing, saving us from slavery to sin. And we celebrate the Passover, but it's because of the reality of what that means about God, and then we live out of that, and our lives are different because of it, and we obey the Lord and trust him. Something tangible out of our lives is supposed to come out of the signs. It is not just for the sake of checking a box and doing the sign. It was possible for them to completely fall apart even though they had the sign. So for us, New Testament Christians, once Jesus came, and us today, encouragement, we've also got those signs, right? When Jesus came back, we don't obviously do circumcision anymore. Circumcision changed over in the early church to baptism. And on the night that Jesus was betrayed, you remember he celebrated the Passover in the upper room with his disciples? And at that point, he looked at them and he said, "This blood, it is my blood. I'm the lamb." And he, at that point, transitioned. You're not going to celebrate the Passover. You're going to celebrate the Lord's Supper. Because I'm here. The lamb was always pointing to me. And now the reality for you that you can understand in more fullness is that it's completely about me. And so we celebrate the Lord's Supper. And there's also the warning that we can be people who have been baptized and celebrate the Lord's Supper and do not live like God's people. Those signs connect a call to obedience and a call to live like the family. So, physical signs of a spiritual reality that are supposed to affect how we live. Okay, now God has brought this new generation across the Jordan. They have reestablished their family identity, and now they're about to go into battle. So we see God saying, you need to know who you are, and then we're going to move into what you're going to do. And so We move into God fought the battle of Jericho. 5:13 in Joshua is where I am. When Joshua was by Jericho, he lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, a man was standing before him with his drawn sword in his hand. And Joshua went to him and said to him, "Are you for us or for our adversaries?" And he said, "No, but I am the commander of the army of the Lord. Now I have come." And Joshua fell on his face to the earth and worshiped and said to him, "What does my Lord say to his servant?" And the commander of the Lord's army said to Joshua, "Take off your sandals from your feet, for the place where you are standing is holy." And Joshua did so. And so we see in this section some beautiful continuity there at the end when this warrior reveals himself as a commander of the Lord's army, and there's a take off your sandals. That should remind us of Moses' experience at the burning bush. So we see continuity between the leader and the God he serves. Most commentators say that this warrior is a pre-incarnate Jesus. That all years and years before Jesus was born, he showed himself as the commander of the army of the Lord. And I just really love how when Joshua meets this guy at first, and he doesn't know who he is because he's asking him, he says, "Are you for us or for our enemies?" And the answer is no, right? And you're like, oh, okay. And he's on the Lord's side. And so the question really to Joshua is, whose side are you on? You're asking me whose side I'm on. I'm on the Lord's side. I'm the commander of the army of the Lord. Whose side are you on? Are you on the Lord's side? Make no mistake, we see from the very beginning, from the entrance of the commander of the Lord's army, that this battle is God's battle. The commander of the army of the Lord is leading the battle. Joshua is there to lead the people, but this is God's battle. So they start to look towards Jericho. Joshua 6, verse 1. Now Jericho was shut up inside and outside because of the people of Israel. None went out and none came in. Remember, their hearts have melted. They are terrified. And the Lord said to Joshua, "See, I have given Jericho into your hand with its king and mighty men of valor." And honestly, if you look at those two sentences together, they don't seem to really make sense because we have the city is shut up from without and within. Nobody's going in or out. And it's, you know, remember, humongous fortified walls. Nobody can get in and out. And God says, "I have given you the city." You're like, those two things don't seem to go together because how are we supposed to get in and fight? And then God gives Joshua the battle plan. And we see that what is impossible with man is completely possible with God. Starting in verse 3. "You shall march around the city, all the men of war going around the city once. Thus shall you do for 6 days. 7 priests shall bear 7 trumpets of ram's horns before the ark. On the 7th day, you shall march around the city 7 times, and the priests shall blow the trumpets. And when they make a long blast with the ram's horn, when you hear the sound of the trumpet, then all the people shall shout with a great shout. And the wall of the city will fall down flat, and the people shall go up, everyone straight before him." So Pastor Brian Habig, in his sermon on this, says that the first thing we need to recognize is that this is strange. So if you just read that and thought, huh, okay, cool, makes sense to me, it only means that you grew up in church, because it does not make sense. It is weird and strange and crazy and just a bizarre thing that God is telling his people to do, and that then they're going to shout and the walls are going to fall down. That is crazy. So it is helpful for us to take a step back and go, that does not make sense to our human minds. That's where we have to start first. And then the second thing to see is through this battle plan, there is absolutely no doubt that God is the one that is fighting the battle. They are along for the ride. Now, God works through their participation. He tells them to march, and he expects them to march. He tells them to shout on the 7th day. He expects them to shout. But God is the one whose hand is knocking down the wall. So when my kids were little, Clay's daddy has a riding lawnmower. He still does. But when they were little, he would have mowed the yard, and we would go over to their house. And I remember in particular Walker, so like a five-year-old Walker, loved to ride on the mower. So Stick would put him on the mower and, you know, turn off the blades, super safety. And he would ride, and Walker would come in and be like, "Mama, I mowed the yard. I drove the lawnmower. It looks so good." And you're like, "Oh, baby, the yard does look good. And you did not mow the yard, nor did you actually drive the lawnmower. But I'm so happy that you enjoyed that little ride along with your granddaddy." And it's the same kind of thing. And Clay's daddy just delighted in that. He's like, "Yeah, buddy, that yard looks good. We're a great team." And there's a little bit of that feeling of, make no mistake, God is doing it all, but he delights to have his people participate. So if we bump now into verse 6, it kind of repeats again, kind of like it did last week. So it's like God tells Joshua, Joshua tells the and so we're going to kind of say the same thing a few things, but we're going to read it all. Verse 6, "So Joshua, the son of Nun, called the priests and said to them, 'Take up the Ark of the Covenant and let seven priests bear seven trumpets of ram's horns before the Ark of the Lord.' And he said to the people, 'Go forward, march around the city, and let the armed men pass on before the Ark of the Lord.'" And so we have army men, Ark of the Lord in the middle, army men. So God is in the center of all of this. "And just as Joshua had commanded the people, the seven priests bearing the seven trumpets of ram's horns before the Lord went forward, blowing the trumpets, with the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord following them. The armed men were walking before the priests who were blowing the trumpets, and the rear guard was walking after the Ark while the trumpets blew continually. But Joshua commanded the people, 'You shall not shout or make your voice heard, neither shall any word go out of your mouth until the day I tell you to shout. Then you shall shout.' So he caused the Ark of the Lord to circle the city, going about it once, and they came into the camp and spent the night in the camp. Then Joshua rose early in the morning, and the priest took up the Ark of the Lord, and the seven priests bearing the seven trumpets of ram's horns before the Lord of the Ark, before the Ark of the Lord walked on, and they blew the trumpets continually. And the armed men were walking before them, and the rear guard was walking after the Ark of the Lord while the trumpets blew continually. And the second day, they marched around the city once and returned into the camp. So they did for 6 days. On the seventh day, they rose early at the dawn of day and marched around the city in the same manner 7 times. It was only on that day that they marched around the city 7 times. And at the seventh time, when the priests had blown the trumpets, Joshua said to the people, 'Shout, for the Lord has given you the city.'" And we know that number 7 God uses all the time to show completion. So here we go. The walls are about to tumble down. "And the city and all that was in it shall be devoted to the Lord for destruction." Now, I will say it is interesting. Some of the commentators say that this little section of instruction maybe was given earlier, because it does feel weird in the heat of battle for Joshua to be like, "Shout!" And then be like, "But the city's going to be for destruction. Don't forget Rahab. Okay, go." Right? So maybe that happened. Or maybe it was said earlier and just put back here for us to read for extra emphasis of, like, in the midst of all of the let's go, don't forget what God said. So we're at verse 17. "And the city and all that is in it shall be devoted to the Lord for destruction." Destroy it all. "Only Rahab the prostitute and all who are with her in her house shall live, because she hid the messengers whom we sent." Okay, y'all, the next verses are a warning and a foreshadowing of trouble to come in the next chapter. "But you, Israelites, going in to fight, keep yourselves from the things devoted to destruction, lest when you have devoted them, you take any of the devoted things and make the camp of Israel a thing for destruction and bring trouble upon it." What are the things devoted to destruction? Just everything. You don't get to take things and bring it back for yourself. You don't get to take a cow. You don't get to take some gold jewelry. Trust the Lord that he's going to take care of you. Don't try to grab at those things to take care of you. all silver and gold, this is verse 19, and every vessel of bronze and iron are holy to the Lord, and they shall go into the treasury of the Lord. So we are going to put those in the temple of the Lord. So the people shouted, and the trumpets were blown as soon as the people heard the sound of the trumpets. The people shouted a great shout, and the wall fell down flat, so that the people went up into the city, every man straight before him, and they captured the city. Then they devoted all in the city to destruction, both men and women, young and old, oxen, sheep, and donkeys, with the edge of the sword. And so, this is a place where we struggle, right? Especially when you stick in the whole, the men, women, and children. God told his people to go in and destroy everybody, every living thing. That is really hard. And we don't understand that. And that is true. I'm not going to try to fix that. I can't. There's no fixing that. It is true that that is really hard. And we need to remember that when God punishes evil, it is good, and he is being just. And we know that all of the people living in the land of Canaan were committing great evil and wickedness. So when God punishes evil, he is acting justly in his good character. He is doing something good. And so while we kind of stand, we look at that and we're like, God, it just feels really harsh. Like, we get it. We get it that there was wickedness and evil, but that just feels, does that maybe feel like too much? And I wonder if maybe a little bit it could help us take one step towards understanding a little, if we kind of personalize that a little bit. And so you think of our own lives. And the idea that someone might harm you physically, sexually, commit evil against you, or that might happen to someone you love, another woman you love, your mama, your sister, your best friend, your daughter. If somebody were to commit something awful against my Alice, would I be telling the Lord, I really don't think you should hold justice on that person? I want all the justice if I don't kill him first. And so when you stop to think about what wickedness really is, God is looking down and saying, I made these people. And when they act evil towards each other, it is never good. And because he is loving and he is just, he will not let it go. And he punishes evil. Now, that doesn't mean that he's not super merciful, and we're going to get there in a moment. But y'all, it is good that evil is punished. It just is. If we served a God who looked down on evil happening and was just like, oh, I mean, that just might be too much. I'm just going to let this one go because I don't want to be mean. And it feels mean to hold that person accountable for the things they did. Y'all, I don't think that's a God we would want to serve and trust to take care of us. Okay, so when we look at the destruction of Jericho, we actually see God, we see him answering two promises. And the first is he's answering a good promise that he will not let wickedness go unpunished. He actually told Abraham, way, remember, like, granddaddy, beginning of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, way back in the family history, he told him, when he told him the whole plan, that he would punish the wickedness of the people in this land. This is back in Exodus 15. He says to Abraham, he's telling this whole story, and he had just said, your people will be in slavery, which is amazing. He tells it all before it happens. And then he says, and they shall come back here, back to the land of Canaan, in the fourth generation, For the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete. The Amorites are one of the people groups that can be thought of as kind of representing all the people groups. The iniquity is not yet complete. They were wicked four generations ago, and they are fully wicked now. And so what it shows is also that God waited. You see some patience in 400 years of God waiting, ready to show mercy if they turn to him. And so we see that in God's sovereign wisdom, at this time, as they're coming into Jericho and the rest of the land, the iniquity is complete. And in God's wisdom, he says, it is full and it is time, and it is time to punish it. And so he's then answering that second promise, and that he's giving his children this land that he promised. So both of those things are happening at the same time. And I love that he gives them this land, and then we can look back in some of the things that he told them in Deuteronomy. This is a book right before this. So he told so many things he told Moses, and then it was like it was when they were supposed to cross over and they didn't, and they were disobedient and they wandered in the wilderness. And the same things apply to these people. So Deuteronomy 9:4. Okay, he's not giving you this land because you're awesome. Deuteronomy 9:4. Do not say in your heart, after the Lord your God has thrust them out before you, it is because of my righteousness that the Lord has brought me in to possess this land. Whereas it is because of the wickedness of these nations that the Lord is driving them out before you. Not because of your righteousness or the uprightness of your heart are you going in to possess their land. But because of the wickedness of these nations, the Lord your God is driving them out before you. And that he may confirm the word that the Lord swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Know therefore that the Lord your God is not giving you this good land to possess because of your righteousness, for you are a stubborn people. In case you thought he was giving you this gift because you're amazing, you're not, you're stubborn. But this is why he's giving you this gift. And you had to go back a little further, Deuteronomy 7, starting in verse 6. He's giving you this inheritance because he's your father and you're his children and he loves you. He's giving it to you not because you're awesome, but because he loves you. Deuteronomy 7, 6. For you are a people holy to the Lord your God. The Lord your God has chosen you to be a people for his treasured possession. Out of all the peoples who are on the face of the earth, he's given you a family t-shirt. It was not because you were more in number than any other people that the Lord set his love on you and chose you, for you were the fewest of all peoples. But it is because the Lord loves you and is keeping the oath that he swore to your fathers. He loves you because he loves you, because he said he was going to love you and he loves you. Clay's mama has a beautiful half bath in her house, and it has really cute leopard wallpaper, and there's always a really yummy candle burning when we go over, and a pretty hand towel and cool art on the wall. And then sitting on the back of the toilet in this really beautiful guest bathroom is this. It is a block of wood, and it has matchstick out the top, and it says, Clay's invention, match air freshener. And Clay Dabbs made this when he was about 6. And the goal is that you can take the match, I mean, I don't know if this works or not, I'm going to try it. And like, if it's stinky in the bathroom, you can strike the match and have the fire and it makes the smell better. I don't know. Who knows? Maybe that's a thing. I don't know. I should ask him if that, like, does that actually work? I don't know. Okay, but so, in the midst of this beautiful bathroom is this air freshener, right? And on the merits of this itself, you know, huh? I mean, it's cute. It's funny. It's not beautiful. Mary Lou loves this thing, right? Because she loves Clay. She does not love this thing because it's like it's an awesome thing that he made. She loves it because she looks at it and she thinks about him and she loves him. And so we see God bringing his children into this good land, not because they're awesome, because they are stubborn, but because he loves them. And so now they come in, they've done the circling, they've done the shouting, the walls have fallen down. And how in the world could you survive the tumbling walls? But we know that Rahab and her family do. So y'all, in the midst of God's judgment on evil and all of the destruction that was happening in the city of Jericho, the only way to survive the destruction was to find safety in God himself. So the only way to survive the destruction that God was bringing was to turn straight to God and find safety in his mercy. We're at Joshua 6, 22. But the two men who had spied out the land, Joshua said, "Go into the prostitute's house and bring out from there the woman and all who belong to her, as you swore to her." Y'all, isn't it how kind is it that God sent familiar faces to her door? I thought about that the other day. In the midst of all the chaos, he didn't just send some random soldiers. He sent back the two men that she knew. That's so kind. So the young men who had been spies went in and brought out Rahab and her father and mother and brothers and all who belonged to her. And they brought all her relatives and put them outside of the camp of Israel. And they burned the city with fire and everything in it. Only the silver and gold, the vessels of bronze and of iron, they put into the treasury of the house of the Lord. But Rahab the prostitute and her father's household and all who belonged to her, Joshua saved alive. And she has lived in Israel to this day because she hid the messengers whom Joshua sent to spy out Jericho. So the walls tumbled down, and we read last week that Rahab's house was built in the wall. So did the walls around her house fall down and her house stay standing? Maybe, not sure. That would be pretty amazing and certainly possible. But God keeps his promise to Rahab that he made through those spies that he would keep her family safe. And so I love it says, Rahab was saved alive and then she was brought in to live in Israel. So they didn't just, like, she wasn't just, her life wasn't saved and then they were like, here you go. See you later. Good luck finding somewhere new to live. No, she was alive, and then they brought her into the family. She became a part of the family of God, and we find out from the genealogy of Jesus, because we talked about that she's in the genealogy of Jesus in Matthew 1, that she married a guy named Salmon, who was an Israelite, and she becomes a part of the family. So we're assuming family t-shirt, part of the smorgasbord. She's taking on the family identity. And y'all, I just think a thing that is beautiful, because then, you know, I said that the signs are, they're supposed to be like something that comes out of your life from that shows you're a part of the family of God. And man, we don't hear a lot more about Rahab, but we have a whole book of the Bible about her son. We have a whole book of the Bible, Ruth, about this Moabite woman who had married into the family of Israel and then been widowed and had fallen on really hard times. And they come back and she ends up in the fields trying to pick up grain to survive of Boaz, who is Rahab's son. And we get to see how Boaz treats this woman. And so if Rahab was full of wickedness, raised in Jericho, was, you know, it was her job to have a brothel, we see some pretty major life change after she becomes a part of the people of Israel and her family identity and what her son is like. She has very obviously raised him to be very different. And we see, y'all, I think it's one of the greatest, it's the greatest love story of the Bible, I think, in my opinion. We see the character of God displayed in Boaz. Like, he's showing the family identity. This woman comes and he provides protection for her. He makes sure that nobody's going to hurt her when she's picking up grain in the fields. And he tells his servants to leave more for her so she has plenty. And then he treats her with respect and with dignity and takes up his responsibility to care for her. And we look at that and we're like, oh, that is what the family character is supposed to look like. That is beautiful. We see it played out in Rahab's son. really in like one of the most sparkling pictures we have in the Bible. Like, that's what the people of God are supposed to act like. It is really, really beautiful. So, to wrap up, in these chapters, it is troubling to us still that God is spreading his kingdom, he is giving them his inheritance, and he has called his people to do it with a sword in their hand, and people are going to die. And that's what it looked like for God's kingdom to spread at that time. So that is obviously not what it looks like for us now, right? To spread God's kingdom does not mean that we're going and killing people. Hallelujah. So what does it look like? What does it look like for us if the commander of the army of the Lord said, I am on the Lord's side? Joshua, are you on the Lord's side? What does it look like for us to be on the Lord's side? Okay, so to close out, and we'll let this be our final prayer too. There are pieces of paper on your table. I'm going to let Mo Leverett sing to us. To kind of answer that question, this song, the tune started coming in my head as I was preparing, and this is from way back in, I hadn't heard this song in a long time. So here we go.
Thank you.
Okay. Amen.